Patrick. Patrick.
You're getting Patrick. Very exotic.
French.
French. Oh, okay. That's very. That's pretty radical.
It's
for
a simple
day
question. Wow. Do you like France?
I do like France. Yeah. I like the sort of the aesthetic. It's probably not the most detailed aesthetic. It's probably a bit of a parody, but I like the things I like about France are sort of like
onions.
No. Well, I do like Breton tops actually. I think they look nice. And I own a few of those.
Do you?
Yeah. I think they look nice. And I like pouring a glass of red wine and, you know, garlic mushrooms. And this is terrible, but this is what I think about. What I think about, and like sitting having a meal outside in the summer, for some reason, for me, is just intrinsically French. I don't know why, but it makes me feel quite continental.
So France for you is garlic mushrooms, red wine, Breton tops, and
eating
outside.
No, not when you put them together like that. No, that's terrible. No. You did ask me, and I'm just trying to, you know, it's like I get flooded with image. Oh, yeah, I guess I'm just a product of a very sort of like staid and stereotyped imagination.
Do you remember when we used to watch Inspector Clouseau films?
Hang on a minute. All right, so you're talking about like coming out. You're cutting from my hackneyed images to Inspector Clouseau.
It's my show.
All right, then.
The Match, because 90 minutes can last a lifetime. Episode 9, 14th of September 1988. PSG v Bordeaux at the Parc des Princes.
By 1988, you could say that Clive Allen was doing okay. He'd forged a career as a goal scorer in two spells at QPR and had become a Spurs legend thanks to one extraordinary season and a series of match-winning performances throughout his time there. He was in demand, and he's one of those players that you look at and wonder what kind of money he'd be worth now. I'm pretty sure that he wonders it as well. He wouldn't be human if he didn't. So how did a man who'd scored 49 goals in one season at Spurs, won every Player of the Year award going, and seemingly with the footballing world somewhere near his feet, end up in Bordeaux? A move abroad, maybe. I mean, these were the days of Van Basten and Hullet at Milan, an increased player movement all around Europe. But to Bordeaux, it seemed that they were ambitious, it seemed that Clive wanted a move, and so it happened. Sometimes transfers are as simple as that. With Clive now scoring in a different language, Bordeaux started the season pretty well. And then they went to the Parc des Princes, that stadium in the south of Paris that shimmers at night, that reeks of cigar smoke, and that gives football one of its great venues. One in which every error, especially in a night game, is painted and magnified in Technicolor. So to Clive Allen and how he was feeling in the tunnel before Bordeaux played Paris Saint-Germain.
It was a big game, and you got the feeling about that as well. There was a fierce rivalry between PSG and Bordeaux. The Parisians didn't like the Bordelais, and you sensed that the players around me, the French players, certainly they were a little uptight. They were a little apprehensive about a big game in the Parc des Princes.
But this was a great team that you were part of. I know you ended up finishing 13th in the league that season, but you had some strong men in that dressing room that day, didn't you? Notably Jean Tigana, the leader of the team, but Alain Roche as well, one of the modern greats really in French football, as is Tigana, and Enzo Schifo as well. So it was you went there with some chance, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We'd started the season reasonably well, and we did have a plethora of talent, and certainly that was led by Jean Tigana, who was the ultimate professional. Obviously vastly experienced as well, and good young emerging players as Alain Roche was, Lisa Azu, who was breaking into the team at that time. So we had a nice mix, and Enzo Schifo was an incredibly talented midfield player.
And where were you at that time in your French career? Still settling in? I mean, it must have been difficult for you, a goal machine in England. Strange move, many would have thought at the time, to go there. Not a move many had made. Where, how are you feeling at that point?
I was still adjusting. I was certainly adjusting to lots of things. It wasn't only the football, which was different. The role that I was played by Aimé Jacquet, who was the coach. The whole experience of living there, the language. Something that I enjoyed, but it was a big challenge. And so it wasn't just on the football field where it was, I wouldn't say it was difficult, but it took some time to get used to.
And how was the language? if you're in the tunnel talking to John Tigana, which I'm sure you did, what would you do?
I'd try with my French. Obviously, there was difficult times, but I think that they appreciated that from day one when I walked in that I wanted to speak French. I wanted to converse with them in French. It was difficult at times. The ironic thing was that Jesper Olsen joined at Christmas, halfway through that season, arriving from Manchester United. And the first morning in the dressing room, I walked in and there were six of the players speaking very good English to him. And I walked in and stopped and thought, my goodness, what's going on here? And Jesper, who was a real character, really dry, obviously Danish international, top player, but had been in England for a number of years at Manchester United. He told them, just walking through the dressing room for the very first time, look, I speak four languages, but I don't speak French. If you want to converse with me, English, Danish, German, whatever you want to speak in a language that I understand, but I don't speak French. And four of them spoke almost fluent English. Of course, I walked in, asked the question, why have you not spoken to me in English? In that typical French way, they all turned around to me and said, Clive, you wanted to speak French, so we spoke French to you. It was funny, and looking back on it, it was pretty hilarious, but they certainly could have helped me a little bit more.
That sounds like the experience of a lot of tourists, I think, in France, that will resonate with people. And tell us about the Parc des Princes back then as well. I mean, it's an incredible ground, being there for these PSG Marseille, PSG Bordeaux, these huge games. But back then, it almost felt more romantic, didn't it? They've cleaned it up a bit, but back then it was noisy, it was nasty, it was passionate, it was everything. Really, it must have been quite a place to walk into.
Oh, it was a great football stadium. And obviously the original game was called off because the pitch was flooded. We actually warmed up half an hour before the kickoff, came back into the dressing rooms. And about 15 minutes before the kickoff time, there was a knock on the door and they said, we think the game's going to be off. And everybody's looking, well, why? They said the rain has come down for 15 minutes and it had flooded the pitch. It was under 2 inches of water. It was cancelled. There was typical chaos in the Parc des Princes. Should we play tomorrow? Can you come back in the week? How are we going to affect? And in the end, we ended up leaving and going back to Bordeaux to return to play the game, obviously later on. But for me, it was very early in the season, and the family had come from England to watch me play in the Parc des Princes against PSG. And of course, 15 minutes before the kickoff, the game was called off.
So strangely, you're playing there for the first time, having warmed up there once two or three weeks ago. So that must have been a weird old experience for you.
Yeah, it was. And obviously, the original game was on Saturday afternoon. This was going to be a Wednesday night and under lights. And I just always think that, it's an iconic stadium, and under lights, there was an amazing atmosphere. 38,000 crowd, and it was noisy.
Did you look round? Do you remember that day and think, this is why I came? Because you'd played in some big grounds, some of the biggest before that already, and had great success there. But it's different, isn't it? And is that what you were looking for, that difference, if you like?
Yeah, I think there was a difference in terms of playing a league game in such a fantastic arena. Obviously, there was a number of other clubs that had big grounds. St Etienne, for example, had really vocal. The old Lyon Stadium as well. So there was some big stadia with big crowds and noisy crowds, but none more so than the Parc des Princes.
And before we talk about the game, French football was kind of special then, wasn't it? I know now it's on telly, as we know, because we work on it. And back then it wasn't so much, but the kits were great. There was a feeling about it. As I mentioned before, there was a bit of nastiness, an edge to it as well at some of the stadiums you've mentioned. And it was maybe not the highest standard at times, but it was special, wasn't it, back then? I mean, you must still be proud to have worn that kit, for starters.
Well, it's my favourite kit, I have to say, and I've played for many teams, but certainly the home kit, all navy blue with the white V, it was a very special kit. And the thing that was different for me, obviously, multiple sponsors all over that kit as well. Very different in the way that the commercialism and the way that they use commercialism, even at that stage, that was all very different, all very new. And it was really exciting that the whole experience was one. I didn't want to pass up the opportunity, and then I didn't want to regret it in later life, looking back saying, I wonder what it would have been like. So I really enjoyed the experience. It was bittersweet. There was good times. There was some difficult times, but it certainly was one I'm glad that I've done now. And it was special. It really was.
Now, let's get the game out of the way, because it didn't necessarily end well for you. I mean, you drew 1-1. We won't go through it in intimate detail, but 57th minute, Bordeaux get a penalty. I mean, in the Parc des Princes with these huge running tracks, with a huge bowl of a stadium, the passion and the atmosphere, you have to take a penalty against Joel Batts, who was pretty good, wasn't he? He was one of the best, very athletic goalkeeper. What's going through your mind at that point with the noise and the craziness? Do you remember if you felt it was a penalty or not, for example? Was it a clear one?
Well, I think in a way it was a little surprise that we got the penalty, because I do remember that there was a challenge and we appealed for it, and more often than not, perhaps playing away from home, playing in Paris, you're not going to get it given. It was given. I always remember that there wasn't too many players in our particular squad who were happy to step up and take the penalties. I nominated very early in the season, said I would take penalties. So in that respect, I had no fear about taking the penalty. And I approached it as I did all the penalties that I took. Obviously, I'd been taking them at Spurs at my previous club before. And again, you know it's a big moment because the game was 1-1. All those things that go through your head, make sure you hit the target, strike the ball, don't change your mind, which is all the things that were going through my mind at the time. And I remember I struck it well, right-footed, top left-hand corner, which was to the goalie's left-hand side. And I thought it was in. I have to say, it was a well-struck penalty, high towards the top corner. Unfortunately, Joel Batts was like a cat. He sprung, he took off, and he clawed it away. He made an unbelievable save. I've got to say that now. But it was a massive moment, not only in my Bordeaux career, but again for the season as well, because obviously a second goal, the way the game was being played, I think we would have won the game. And it ends up that we come away with it with a point when really we should have got three. And some things you live to regret, and I wonder what would have happened had it been a winning goal.
Because it was pivotal, wasn't it? In both your time in France, really, and Bordeaux's season, because as I mentioned earlier, they ended up finishing 13th in the league. If you'd got momentum then, if you'd won at PSG, and I mean, Marseille were the best team in France, but if you'd gotten a role, you know, who knows what might have happened, and then who knows what might have happened to you as well.
Yeah, I think with the squad of players we had, with the quality that we had, we should have been contending the league title. Obviously, on going to Bordeaux, I did a lot of research in terms of the nature of the club. And people who I respected, who knew a lot about French football, said to me, you know that Bordeaux are the Liverpool of France, and Liverpool at that time through the 80s were so powerful, so dominant. They won the cup or won the Ligue 1 cup or won the league every year. So I went to a club expecting to be successful and to win things. So, and that was a big moment in that season, because we'd started reasonably well. We were amongst the league leaders. And we had a difficult time after that for a few weeks, where we sort of levelled out and ended up mid-table.
And just going back to something you've hinted at, you said that there were people who you didn't think wanted to take a penalty in that squad. I mean, you might have been the natural penalty taker anyway, but does that mean that John Tigana or Enzo Schifo didn't necessarily want to take a penalty? That would be surprising.
I can remember, Enzo would have taken one, but Tigana and Enzo weren't the best of friends, I have to say that. They didn't hit it off, although as a pair, midfield players, quite exceptional. You know, Tigana, I think he saw in Enzo all the things that he couldn't do, and then he saw in Enzo all the things he did that Enzo could never do in terms of covering the ground, doing the hard yards. So that was a strange relationship. And Jean, as far as I know, wasn't a penalty taker. There was one or two others who just really were not interested at all. They didn't want to put themselves in that situation. But that was for them to decide. And even after missing that penalty, we had a penalty shootout in the French Cup later in the season. And it was after extra time, a penalty shootout against Beauvais. And I put my hand up and took a penalty and scored. And I remember in that huddle just before that penalty shootout, players looked at me and they couldn't believe that I was happy to actually step up and take one. I was asked. I said, yeah, I'll take one, and did and scored. But there was a few that didn't. And even the great Eric Cantona played in that cup game and missed the last penalty, which meant we were eliminated that season from the cup.
Because he came later in the season to that Bordeaux side, which we might talk about in a second. But going back to Joel Batts quickly, do you remember if he said anything? Did he give you a look or anything like that?
No, he was just euphoric. The crowd went crazy. Obviously, it was. I've got to say it again, an unbelievable save. But it was a big moment in my career in French football.
Yeah, because people are listening and wonder why we're talking about this. But what happens next is pretty extraordinary and something you definitely never experienced before. I don't think any of us have or experienced again, because next day you go into the training ground,
you train, don't you? And then tell us what happens afterwards.
Yeah, we had the normal warm down because it was a Wednesday game. We were then starting to prepare for the Saturday league game. And on the Thursday, we were in a little bit of footing, as it was called, massage and relaxation, any sort of treatment that you needed. And I remember it was afternoon they brought us in, sitting in the dressing room alongside Tigana, who I used to change it with. And Amy Jacquet, who was the coach, walked in and walked across and said, Clive, he said, you must see the president at 5 o'clock. I said, OK, no problem, that's fine. So as I turned, I looked at Tigana and said, John, what's this? And he was waving at me with his right hand. He said, Clive, au revoir. And I went, what? He said, au revoir. Whether it was tongue-in-cheek, and he was actually joking with me, but little did I know what was coming with my meeting with the president.
And just to explain who this president was, is Claude Bez, one of the most notorious, after Bernard Tapie, probably figures in the history of French football.
Well, at that time, Bernard Tapie, who was the president of Marseille, and Claude Bez, the president of Bordeaux, were the most powerful presidents in French football. You could say almost running French football at that time.
And Claude Bez drove a pink Cadillac, I think famously, which presumably you saw. I mean, presumably you parked it in the car park at the ground, I'm guessing. And so you go in to see him. He's an extraordinary individual who ended up, of course, going to prison, didn't he? And corruption and so on and so forth. But that's not part of this story, but that's part of his character. So what happened when you went in the meeting? Tigan has waved you goodbye, probably putting the fear of God into you. So what happens when you then go and see him?
Well, I went to his house, I remember, and went into his study in a lovely house he had, went into the study, and there he was sitting on this beautiful leather chair, high. He wasn't the tallest of men, but he was sitting high up above me, and I'd slumped down into this little chair across the other side of the desk. And I always remember his opening line was, Clive, you are a great player, but you must go away. Sorry, Mr. President? Clive, you must go away. He said, you played at Tottenham, you scored goals, fantastic. You come to Bordeaux, it is not working. You must go away. So I said, I don't understand what you mean. He said, go find a team. You must find a team. And that was it. That was the sum total of the meeting. Obviously, then it meant the agent who had orchestrated the move got involved. He spoke to the club, and Didier Couicou, who's a general manager who spoke very good English, he then got involved, and I'm speaking to Didier, what does the president mean? And, oh, don't worry, we'll sort this out, and this is what happens.
I mean, did you get the impression it happens a lot, that this was something that had happened before and the players had maybe eventually stayed?
Yes, I think that undoubtedly it was, and again, it's not until later years you actually find out exactly the way the club was being run and what was happening and how he was trading players, basically, the president. And when an opportunity come up, he would move players, bring them in, move them out. And that's the way he worked. But obviously, after missing a penalty in such an important game, to be told you can go away was extraordinary. Although I never had any intention at that moment in time of leaving the club, because I was enjoying it. I was enjoying the whole experience and the way things were going. I'd started the season reasonably well. I'd scored a few goals. The team was still bedding down. We had 9 new players at the beginning of the season, so it was going to take time for us to gel as a team.
Yeah, and so you feel that he was using you missing the penalty as an excuse to try and trade you and make money off the back of the deal, rather than being so angry at you missing the penalty that he wanted to get rid of you?
Undoubtedly, yeah. And knowing what I know now, that was what happened. And it wasn't just me. Other players were in exactly the same situation from time to time throughout the season, called in to see the president. You know what was happening. He was trying to trade and move. You were pawns in a game that he was playing.
Yeah, it was chaos at times, wasn't it? I mean, you'd signed strange players at times, didn't you? I know Cantona came, but didn't you have the two sort of Yugoslav brothers, one of whom was and the other not so?
Well, the left back was the one that stayed. And in effect, as I arrived, the striker left and was, as far as I was aware, although I didn't play with him, a very good player. But unfortunately, his brother, the left back, Zlatan Vujovic, he was a left back that played anywhere on the pitch except left back. And we're playing games and drove Tigana, the captain, to distraction, because he'd end up at right wing, left wing, right back, never in the left back slot. He was a character, fantastic athlete, wasn't the best footballer, but a little bit crazy. Yugoslav, who was crazy. And again, he moved, there was changes. And actually, when he was moved out, it gave the opportunity for Lisa Azu to come in as a 16, 17-year-old and start what was a magnificent career in the team.
It's funny how it happens. One of the great French left-backs, if not the greatest, with respect to others, of course, gets his chance because a sort of maniac who never plays at left-back, pops up on the right wing, finally shoots his bolt, I suppose. Going back to the Claude Bez thing, firstly, did you see the pink Cadillac? Was it in the...
I saw it once, yes, yeah. It was outrageous, absolutely outrageous. But you didn't expect anything else from the president because that was the type of character he was.
And you did stay for the season. So how did that relationship... You've been called in and he said, bye-bye. You've said no. Obviously, there's been agent chat and so on, which you're not necessarily part of because you've said, I want to stay. You then do stay. You're still in the team. You ended up scoring quite a lot of goals. Do you see the president again throughout the season until the end, which we'll talk about? Or is it just things carry on under Aimé Jacquet as normal?
Oh, yeah, you did. And obviously, you conversed predominantly with the general manager, Didier Couicou. He was always at the training ground. Day-to-day communication was... to him, which obviously went back to the president. At games, we would see the president, and it was as if nothing happened. 2 weeks later, you score a goal, and yeah, you're fantastic, and hello, Clive, how's things? And quite incredible, really, but I suppose all part of the experience as well.
So how did that dynamic end up in the dressing room? We've moved on quite a lot from the penalty now, but when Cantona came, under Aimé Jacquet, Schifo's there, Tigana's there, Roche is there, who'd go on to be a great player, as we've said, and plenty of other good players in that squad. Was it chaotic in the dressing room, especially if you throw Cantona in there?
It actually came after another meeting with Claude Bez, where he said to me, it was with Bez and Aimé Jacquet, the coach, and Couicou, and they said that they'd watched a lot of the footage of my games at Spurs, and that you had a player by the name of Chris Waddle who crossed the ball and you scored. He crossed the ball and you scored. So he says, we've got Cantona. We have gone and got Cantona, and we've got Jesper Olsen on the left. And Cantona, really, I suppose, as a Hoddle-type player, he will make passes, you will score the goals. Jesper Olsen will cross the ball, you will score goals. Is that okay? And of course, yeah, that's fine. In their thinking, it was as clear as that was going to happen and it was going to work. And that's what they did. Although I'd have to say they bent the rules a little to get Cantona in because transfers shouldn't have been allowed at that stage of the season. It was the last 3 months of the season. I remember them writing off Jean-Marc Ferry, really talented right winger, who supposedly had a season-ending injury, which meant that he couldn't play. So we should be allowed to bring in a replacement for him. It wasn't in the rules, but they did it. And it was Claude Bez and Bernard Tapie. So, you know, it's quite incredible now when I look back at the way these things unfolded. But, yeah, so Eric was a young player. He'd thrown his shirt in the coach's face. Everybody in French football were disgusted with him. He'll never play for them again. And so we were happy, or Bordeaux as a club were happy to take him for those final 3 months of the season.
And did you like him? What was he like?
Yeah, he was a real character. He was undoubtedly a talent, a young talent, precocious talent. And I enjoyed playing with him, yeah, because he was so clever. He was, you know, all the things that you saw later on in his career, he showed glimpses of that at an early age.
It must have been interesting training at Bordeaux at that time. I'm just thinking of Schifo and Cantona, some of the skills, some of the, you know, little keepy uppies that you do. That probably worth watching.
It was, yeah. It was good to see. But the driving force behind it all was always Tigana. Tigana was the captain. For me, the ultimate professional. He drove everybody. He was a moaner, but he was a moaner in the right way, in that he demanded of everyone the best all the time, even from little squares in the morning. He never gave the ball away. And if you did, he wasn't happy with you. And that was all part of the experience that I really enjoyed. He was about 34 at that time. He was at the end of his career, but you understood why he was such a top player, highly respected. And he was quality. He really was. He was a general, the way that he conducted himself.
And like Serge Blanco, the great French fullback, he fit that brilliant cliche of the French sportsman, super fit, but he smoked, didn't he, as well, Tigana?
He smoked. He had an ankle that was, well, that was decrepit, to be perfectly honest. I've seen many times on a Friday him taking injections in the ankle to play on the Saturday to basically prolong his playing career for as long as he could. So, yeah, he was an amazing captain to have worked with.
Let's move it forward. He's told you once that he's going to
get rid of you, Claude Bez. And then come the end of the season, when people look at Clive Allen's career, they see Bordeaux for one season. Oh, he's played in England and he's gone to Bordeaux and he's come back because he's not happy or whatever. But that wasn't true, was it? You wanted to stay there, didn't you? Because you enjoyed it. And they actually did well next season, proving your point that once they got it together, they would really rocket up the table. So how did it come to an end?
Well, it was really bizarre because obviously the way the French season is sort of, I say, elongated, you only get a short break in the summer. You have a winter break for a couple of weeks, but you only have 2 weeks break in the summer. So came back to England. There was some speculation that he was going to trade players. He was going to bring some in, move some out. But I still had 2 years to run of a three-year contract, and I was like expecting to go back and get involved and start the following season. First day back pre-season, so the first day of the start of the second season, you arrive at the training camp, there's 24 bags of kit laid out, and there's 34 players. So we're sort of, we're looking at one another.
And when you say laid out, are we in the dressing room?
No, outside, in the car park. You get out the car. All the bags were lined up, numbered and lined up. And obviously you take them from there down into the dressing rooms, which are underneath the chateau, beautiful training ground with all the dressing rooms were sunken underneath in the basement, the hydro pools, a wonderful, wonderful facility. But we're standing literally in the car park and Kouikou, the general manager, comes out with Amy Jacquet and reels off the numbers and allocates the bags. So off they go, players, you know, Tigana, four, off he went, whatever it was. And there's 10 of us standing there with no kit, no bags. Ah, interesting. So Didier, what do we do? So he says, you see the hut over the other side of the training camp, which was about two pitches across. You must go and change over there. Why? Because we don't want you anymore. You must go away. You 10, go away. And I never, ever forget that, well, what do we do for kit? You have kit from last year, you use last year's kit. So it was a clear indication you're no longer wanted, in complete contrast to the first day in the season before. When you arrive, they hug, there's your kit, just have a look at it. If there's anything that's missing, when you go downstairs, just go through the door on the left, you'll be measured for your suit, your jacket, your shoes and socks and your tie and everything. When they wanted you, they could not do enough for you. When they didn't want you, it was bye-bye, simply bye-bye. So the first day, I remember we went over, and as a group, we're saying, right, lads, what are we going to do? So we said, well, we must train because it's pre-season. We must start to do our fitness work. So I remember us running one way around the training ground, and the main group was running the other until we crossed paths. And of course, it was all jokes. It was all, and there the 24 are waving, oh, au revoir, au revoir. And then I remember I had this feeling, right, I'm not going to be treated like this. So I almost like dug my heels in. I'm going to stay. I'm not going anywhere. So a few days later, the 10 went down to 7. Players went to Paris or down to the Côte d'Azur, or they went to another club. 3 days later, 5 players. So I'm now in the last 5.
And you're still in a group training. So this group that's running the opposite way is just getting smaller and smaller.
Well, the main group's doing all their stuff, but we're a group on our own, basically doing our own thing. And this went on for another few days. And then I got the call, Manchester City are interested. We want you to go back to England and speak with them. And okay, fine. Came back to Manchester, spoke to them. It was sort of agreed and sort of done. And went back and went in to see the president, because he had an office based at that in the chateau. Went in because I'd arrived back. So I was now down to the last 3, because that was 3 or 4 days away. So there's only 3 of us left.
Do you remember who the other 2 were?
You know, I can't remember now. No, I can't.
Do you remember who any of the 10 were, the other 9, to start off with, who was let go?
There was Dominic Thomas, who was a fullback, who I was very good friends with him. There was 2 or 3 others that, Eric Pion, the centre-half. There was a goalkeeper, the second goalkeeper to Dominic Dropsy. I'm not sure if Didier Senac was in that group as well. Some big players. So this was the crunch meeting with the president. So he says, Clive, you must go away. So I said, look, I know. I said, but I'm happy. I have 2 more years. I don't want to go back to Manchester. I'm going to stay here.
And just to make it clear, that was true. You weren't trying to play games. You did want to stay. It wasn't trying to get more money.
No. I decided that perhaps wasn't the right move for me. and Manchester City had just been promoted back to the top division in English football. So, and it was a young team, and I just thought, I was 29 then, so they were looking at me as a more experienced player, bringing me back to England. So I sat with the president. I said, no, Mr. President, I'm going to stay. So you will train on your own? Yeah, I'll train on my own. I'll do my own thing. Ah, he said, very interesting. So I said, I've always honoured contracts, never asked for a transfer. When I've been sold, it's been because the clubs have agreed, and then I think that it's the right move for me. Okay, he says, I understand. He says, but you have your car today? So I says, yeah. I said, so he said, you finished training? So I said, yeah, I'm finished. I'm about to go back home. He said, you must give me your car keys, which was a club car. We was sponsored by Opel. We all had their club cars. So I said, what do you mean? So he said, you must give me your car keys. So I said, I slid the car keys across the desk. Okay, what? Why is this? So he says, you see the gendarme at the gate, which was about a mile long drive out of the training camp. So I said, yeah. He said, you drive the car out the gate, you will be arrested because it's not your car anymore. So I said, oh, okay. I said, you have the keys. I don't need the car. So he said, how will you get home? So I said, I'll call my wife. She'll come and pick me up. Ah, he said, very clever. So I said, okay. So I got up. And I walked down the drive, phoned my wife, walked down the drive, and she came and collected me. And now, obviously, it's like, what's going to happen? Well, it unfolded that over the next couple of days, the deal was done with Manchester City. They obviously wanted me to go. They didn't want me there. I couldn't stay there training with one or two or on my own. It just wasn't going to work. And eventually come to the agreement that that we would come back, and I would come back to England. But it was fascinating. In all my experiences, obviously, in English football, I'd never been treated like that. It never happened like that. But that was the way it was. They wasn't doing anything different to me that they were doing to the other players. And that hit home to me when, looking back on it, when we had the midwinter break, you turn back up for the second half of the season, you do a mini pre-season. And at that point, because there was freedom of contract in France then, in January, the players were already talking about where they were going in the summer. And I sat in the dressing room. I always remember, and I always go back to it. We were in the old UEFA Cup. We were about fourth in the league. We hadn't started the French Cup. And yet there were six of the players in the squad who said, yeah, well, I'm going to Toulouse, and I'm going to Saint Etienne, and I'm going up to Lyon. Well, when? Oh, in the summer. So what are you going to do for the 6 months till then? Well, tranquil. Easy. Hold on a minute, we're playing for everything here. And that was something that, an early view and an early indication of what's now happening here with contracts and becoming a free agent on January the 1st and lining up what you're moving on to and what you're going to. So it wasn't just from a football point of view, but the whole thing was just a fantastic education. And like I say, it was bittersweet. There was good moments, and there was some things that I just couldn't believe, but now you see it as common practice now in football, even in this country now.
And as you mentioned, I wasn't sure whether to ask you this, but you mentioned your wife in the car. Earlier, if we rewind, before the penalty, before the match we started off with, they'd gone to see her, hadn't they? Yes. The people from the club, because you weren't scoring, or had you not scored for a while, and it was to check if you're okay?
It was six games in at the start. See, I remember it well because I trained, got back home, and all of a sudden it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There was a knock at the door, and it was Emi Jacquet and Didier Kouikou with the doctor, the kliné, the masseur, and the general man who just looked out. If you needed anything, if you needed a new fridge or you needed a television, they'd sort it out for you. He was the man. So there's these four people on the doorstep.
Just to clarify, closer, because this happened to you, so you see it as normal, but this was an afternoon off. Yeah. You trained in the morning, yeah, and you're at home with your wife. Yeah. What normal people do, and this was not a meeting that had been planned.
No, I had no idea that this.
So it's a knock on the door.
Yeah, it's a knock on the door. And what's the problem? Obviously, you know, I'm surprised. Jacquet spoke a little English, but not a lot, but Kouikou was fluent. He said, Clovis, no problem, but you must go in the other room. Well, what do you mean go in the other room? Well, we'd like to speak to your wife. Is your son, Ollie, our only child at that time, was 18 months old, so he was a toddler. what's the problem? No, no, it's no problem. We just need to speak to her. So they spent, I think they spent about 45 minutes with her and then just up and left. So obviously I went in, said to my wife, what? She said, no, they just asked, is everything okay? Are you happy? Is your son, has he settled? Is he okay? She said, yes. And then they said to my wife, are there any problems? Does Clive have any problems? So she said, well, there is one thing that he'd like to know about, because you keep substituting him on 70 minutes, the first six games, 70 minutes. So by all accounts, this is the story that my wife has told me, no, it's no problem. So my wife said, well, it is. Clive doesn't like to be substituted. No, no, no. He's come to France. He's playing Saturday evening. The climate is warmer. It's hotter. He has to adjust to all of this. We don't want him to fatigue in the last 20 minutes. So we take him out 70 minutes. Yeah, but if he scored a goal, he wants to score another goal. She said, I know how his mind works. No, no, no. Tell him. Please do not worry. We will increase the time. Basically, it was all mapped out. It was all precise. They knew exactly what they were doing and why they were doing it. But they hadn't told me, the most important person. And I'm thinking, now you're telling me, I can understand what they're doing. But at the time, up goes the ball 70 minutes and off I go. And I'm like, well, good game, bad game or whatever. It wasn't going to make any difference. This was the way that they were sort of integrating me into into French football with the team. So it was bizarre, but you, on the other hand, you could understand why they did it. And they left with the message, said to my wife, he must now play well every game. That was it. So we have done everything for you. My wife said, yeah, we're very happy. So he must now perform. And that was a message they left us with. So it was like, we've done everything. You've got no complaints. Now you must perform.
I tell you, it says something about the French relationship with men and women and the respect, doesn't it? It's extraordinary. So as we come to the end of this, the one thing working with you a lot, your eyes light up every time you talk about Bordeaux. It's interesting. I'm not saying they don't when you talk about Tottenham. Of course they do. But it's clearly something. You've been back, haven't you, the opening of the new stadium. I mean, it's something. Yeah. 1 year and it means the world to you, doesn't it? It really meant a lot to you.
It was very special. It was an incredible experience. And I'm... to this day, and I'll never regret, obviously, I would have loved to have stayed longer. We've been back as a family. We've been back to the area where we lived to show Oliver, obviously my son's now 30 years old, and our other children that were born later had no recollection or no knowledge of what it was. So we're very happy with the whole experience and only wish that we could have stayed longer, but it's not until later years that you actually knew exactly the reasons why. But it was fantastic.
Can you remember what you thought when you heard Claude Bez had gone to prison? Because the story, it was pre-internet, wasn't it? So it wasn't like it would be now. It would be on Twitter and so on. But it must have filtered through, or Tigana rang you or something. But could you remember, were you surprised, for example? I suspect not.
No, I wasn't surprised, because actually it all made sense in the end. It reputedly, he'd siphoned something like 30 million euros, 30 million francs at the time, out of the club in transfers. And subsequently, I had dealings with officials from Paris who had all this information, all the knowledge, all the books and everything that had been done. So again, you know, in a way, you shake your head in disbelief, but you then understand and realise what was actually happening, what was going on from year to year, from the transfer periods and the number of players that were moved in and out. He was an accountant from Guadeloupe who saw a vehicle in what was a great football club, and still is a massive football club, and that's what happened. So... and I was in the thick of it, as it had to be.
And in a way, it's good for you, because the waving bye-bye and all of that was nothing to do with you as a player. It was everything to do with money. So I suppose, in a way, once you realise that, then you weren't maybe treated so badly, because it wasn't anything to do with you.
No, exactly. And I think when you look back again and you reflect on what could have been and what might have been, it wouldn't have made any difference. Because in all honesty, if they'd have been offered big money for Tigana at 34, you know, legendary captain of the club, he would have sold him. He would have moved him on, because that's the way they were working.
If you'd scored the penalty back in September, you must have thought about this. Do you think you'd still have been there the following year? Or did that excuse it gave him just allow that narrative to go on and on and on, and eventually Clive's out the door?
Looking back, reflecting back now, I don't think it would have made any difference. because of the nature of the way the whole thing unfolded, I think if I'd have, I was worth something to them, they would have sold me, whether it be to an Italian club, German club, another French team, whatever. That's what would have happened. So I actually had no control in what was going to happen. I had no control in my destiny at that time in terms of the way that they were dealing with you.
Just remind us, it was a brilliant penalty, right?
Oh, top corner. Honestly, I struck it well, but it was one of the best penalty saves you'll ever see.
And you know I've been looking for footage. I haven't got it yet, but if you scuffed it down the middle, you're never living this down.
No, I remember it well, vividly. I struck it right foot. It was going up to Joel Batz's left-hand side, and he clawed it out of the top corner. Oh, it was incredible save.
Now, I want to leave the final word of this, and thank you so much for doing it, to the 18-month-old Ollie at the time, because this is great. You were playing the game, and he's just learning French, just starting to speak, isn't he? And he's listening on the radio with people in the house. And tell us what happened.
Well, he was actually a housekeeper who was staying with my wife because we were away. She was kicking the ball around in the hallway with Ollie. He's taking shots. And all of a sudden on the radio, it comes out, Il est manqué, he's missed. So she was explaining to my wife, Lisa, who was pretty much fluent anyway after 3 months. She understood what was happening. And Ollie, being Ollie and being a baby, being a young boy, he said to her, "No, it's not monkey, it's monkey." And she didn't get it. And of course, Lisa was in hysterics saying to Ollie, "No, papa le monkey," because she's trying to teach him French. And it was hilarious afterwards. I'm looking back on it, absolutely. So Ollie thinks I'm a monkey and I missed the penalty, il est monkey.
Clive carried on scoring goals for Manchester City and Chelsea and West Ham before he called it a day in 1995. It's fans of QPR and Spurs who will always hold the biggest candle to him, but he's still much loved in Bordeaux for going there, for loving it, for the goals that he scored and for the graceful way that he eventually left. As for Claude Bez, he went to prison for fraud in the same year that Clive retired and died at just 58, 4 years later, 6 months after Aimé Jacquet had won the World Cup with France. There's comedy in this story, but a dash of tragedy as well. Next week, the story of a young player thrown into his first game, out of position and facing someone who'd become a superstar. It's our penultimate episode called Andrea Pirlo and the Debut from Hell.
He was one of those mythical characters that we knew existed at this team that was, 30 kilometres down the road. Our local rivals in Brescia, but knowing that was going to play centre-back, knowing how good he was or supposed to be, because up until this point, you don't know, but you believe what you hear because they can't all be wrong. And they also had another character he was 6 foot six plus, Emiliano Bonazzoli. You needed a stepladder to get up to him. So he was actually my primary concern. How am I going to win balls in the air against him? How am I going to get anywhere near Andrea Pirlo? And how am I going to cope at a higher age group playing out of position? This was a nightmare.
The Match is produced and presented by me, Dave Farah, and is a Speechless Media production in association with IMG Media. Special thanks for this episode to James Eastham, and as always to Matt Vines for his excellent editing, and Steve Tebb and Ollie Neen of IMG Media for their support. I know that every podcast, including this one, asks you to rate and review it on iTunes, but if you do have 5 minutes, it's an enormous help. You can tell us what you think, you can be honest, and you can help make sure that we keep telling stories.